and Coulter, G. Why can't Trump accept defeat like the Democrats? By Ann Coulter on November 18, 2020. In 1980, Democratic President Jimmy Carter lost in a landslide to Ronald Reagan, 489-49 in the Electoral College. So naturally, Democrats concluded that Reagan had committed treason in order to steal the election. To wit, his campaign had conspired with Iranian Ayatollahs to prevent 52 American hostages from being released until after the election. And who can blame them? Carter's economic policies had produced a 21% interest rate, a 17% mortgage rate and a 15% inflation rate in the coveted hat trick of presidential incompetence. His brilliant strategic ploy of abandoning the Shah of Iran had led to a 154% spike in oil prices and Islamic lunatics seizing our embassy and holding Americans hostage in Tehran, where they remained for 444 days, until Carter was safely removed from office. With all that going for them, plus that old Mondale magic, Democrats were dumbstruck that they lost the 1980 election. What other than a dirty trick could explain it? The Democrats' theory was that a month before the election, members of Reagan's campaign had clandestinely met with representatives of the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in Paris and offered to sell him weapons in exchange for a promise not to release the hostages, thus denying Carter a huge election eve triumph. In other words, liberals believed the Islamo-fascist cutthroats who had been toying with Carter like a cat with a ball of yarn wanted Carter replaced by someone stronger, like Reagan. How else to explain the fact that, minutes after Reagan's inauguration, the hostages were released? A more plausible theory was given in a Jeff McNally cartoon showing Khomeini reading a telegram aloud, "It's from Ronald Reagan. It must be about one of the Americans in the den of spies, but I don't recognize the name. It says remember Hiroshima." The lunatics behind the October surprise conspiracy theory might have spent their days in obscurity, talking to supercomputers of the future, as one theorist claims she did, except that, after a decade of periodic eruptions and in disreputable publications like the New York Times, Flora Lewis, August 1987, The Nation, Christopher Hitchens, July 1987, and Playboy magazine, September 1988, The Times began flogging the story in 1991, beginning with a lengthy op-ed by Columbia University professor Gary Sick. Sick had been President Carter's principal aide on Iran during the hostage crisis, which would be like being FDR's chief advisor on sneak attacks in December 1941. Columbia hired Sick as a professor, apparently unable to find Carter's aide in charge of gas prices. Soon, other news outlets such as PBS's Frontline and ABC's Nightline began treating crazies howling at the moon as if they were serious intel sources. Carter himself called for a Blue Ribbon Commission to investigate, saying, "It's almost nauseating to think that this could be true." Which is ironic because that was my reaction, word for word, upon learning that Carter had been elected president. The theory that Reagan had arranged to keep our hostages in captivity until after the election was originally hatched by Lyndon LaRouche, the second most ridiculous person named Lyndon to ever run for president. One of the key American witnesses to the conspiracy, and Hitchens' main source, was paranormal expert Barbara Honegger, who said she heard voices from the future and that satellites were directed to part the clouds during Reagan's inauguration so that the sun would shine only on him. Years later, Honegger promoted the theory that clocks stopped at the Pentagon at 9:32 a.m. on September 11, proving that the plane could not have hit at 9:37. So she was a credible source. Another major player was fake CIA agent Richard Brennecke, who was about to be fired from his lucrative job with a left-wing think tank for failing to substantiate a different conspiracy theory, that Vice President Bush was running an Israeli-backed drugs for arms operation in Central America. To stave off his firing, Brennecke suddenly remembered that not only had he heard of the October surprise, he had been there. Alar Ouchai confirmed that he had seen Brennecke at the meeting, something Brennecke himself had not remembered until that very moment. One by one, each of the Reagan campaign aides allegedly at the imaginary Paris meeting had their precise locations proved for nearly every minute of the crucial dates of October 17 to 19, when the sources claimed the secret meeting had taken place. Then it turned out Brennecke wasn't at the non-existent meeting, either. Signed credit card receipts proved he was at a Star Trek convention in Seattle on October 17 to 19. Just kidding. It was a martial arts tournament. These were among the nuts behind the October surprise fable pushed by the major media and the Democratic Party for more than a decade after Reagan's trouncing of Carter in 1980. Democratic-led congressional committees spent millions of dollars investigating the nutso conspiracy theory, eventually concluding there was nothing to it, which I could have told them for, say, $300,000. At the conclusion of the House's investigation, Representative Lee Hamilton, the House Democrat who had chaired the October Surprise Task Force, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, saying, "The task force report concluded there was virtually no credible evidence to support the accusations." On the same day, The Times published a rebuttal op-ed by Gary Sick. "And that, kids, is how you can see the presidential election with grace and dignity."